Welcome to Instigators of Change, a Coastal Ventures podcast where we take a look at innovative ideas, the people who come up with them, and those who invest in them. I'm Kara Miller, and this week, what happens when you build a tiny company that can barely make ends meet?
There was a likelihood that they could have been sued out of existence, right? Or any day their growth could have stopped.
And then all of a sudden, the big guys start to realize you're hot on their heels.
YouTube was a massive search engine and a real viable threat to Google, which, you know, Google Video was not picking up. And so they had the foresight to know that video was moving online.
How YouTube went from a company maxing out credit cards to buy needed equipment to being acquired for more than $1.5 billion. And that's all in about a year and a half. The strange story of YouTube, coming right up on Instigators of Change. YouTube went so far so fast, it's kind of hard to know where to start. But as good a day as any is the day that one of the founders of the company collapsed. And initially, no one knew why. It was 2007, the night of the CNN-YouTube Democratic primary debate hosted by CNN's Anderson Cooper.
Tonight is really something of an experiment. This is something we've never done before. What you're about to see is, well, it's untried. We're not exactly sure how it's going to work. The candidates on this stage don't know how it's going to work. Neither do their campaigns. And frankly, we think that's actually a good thing.
And if the experiment, the union between an upstart social media company and an old school cable news network, if that was strange, it's because social media wasn't much of a thing yet.
We had just sort of entered the 24-hour cable sort of political circus, but, you know, Twitter was just beginning. Facebook was still sort of a dorm room site, right? It was not mainstream at all to incorporate social media into politics and in the political coverage.
That's Mark Bergen, a tech journalist who's written for Bloomberg and Recode and is out this week with a new book, Like, Comment, Subscribe.
Two things happened. One, that cycle, YouTube was sort of like the hot new thing. It was like Bill Clinton playing the saxophone on a City Hall show. Politicians went on YouTube. So John McCain, Barack Obama, at that point, I believe Ron Paul may have still been in the running. And he was hugely popular on YouTube.
But as popular as the site had become, it was probably no surprise when YouTube's contribution to traditional politics was kind of irreverent.
The most viewed video question on YouTube was this one.
What are your thoughts on a recent poll suggesting that 88% of Californians elected Governor Schwarzenegger in hopes that a cyborg of his nature could stop a future nuclear war?
Yeah.
Mostly, the quirkiness of YouTube was not the focus of the debate. After the politicians on the stage, from Barack Obama to John Edwards to Dennis Kucinich to Hillary Clinton, after they chuckled at that cyborg question, they were faced with more mainstream fare. Would they call themselves liberal? Are they more than just average politicians? Things like that. And that night at the Citadel in South Carolina, Anderson Cooper shared the auditorium with YouTube founders Steve Chen and Chad Hurley, and with Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, which had recently acquired YouTube.
I would say a political insider, a diplomat, a kind of consummate schmoozer. Eric had arranged, from my understanding, this partnership with CNN.
Schmidt, as Bergen reports in his new book, leaned across to YouTube's founders and said, "You've arrived, gentlemen." But the night would end not in joy, but in panic.
Steve was actually taking a flight and he had a seizure. And Steve would later, years later, sort of, he finally got treatment in San Francisco that he deemed he kind of was a workaholic. Too much working, too much drinking, too much staying up all night, too much coffee. And this sort of put him out of commission. He would kind of stay around the company for, I believe, a year or so more, but more or less stepped away after that medical issue.
Chen had been a major force in engineering at YouTube, and he did keep attending some meetings after his seizure before suffering another seizure about a year later. Only a couple years before, Chen, Hurley, and Jawad Karim had been present at the founding. Karim had gone back to school pretty early on. So by mid-2007, after Chen's seizure, Hurley was the only one involved in YouTube's day-to-day operations. Things had changed a lot since 2005 when the founders argued over what this site should be. But they knew one thing for sure, Bergen says. it was important for the site not to look too good.
There was this idea that if something was too professional looking, right, it might not get everyday users, right? Like, there's this fascinating debate they had sort of between being a dating site, right, or being like a place for like high-end filmmakers. In some ways, it was Hot or Not was a really popular site at the time, and Vimeo, which was around the same time, right? Vimeo is this, it's a site for, we still think of it now, you know, it's aspiring filmmakers and artists, right? You wouldn't kind of go on there and put your homemade videos or like a lot of the sort of lo-fi amateur stuff that really made YouTube take off. And they also wanted, I think one of the sort of genius aspects of YouTube that really made them succeed is that it was incredibly user-friendly and pretty easy to navigate, easy to upload, easy to understand. And that was something that had like a very low hurdles to getting sort of out of the gate, millions of users, and just really didn't slow down since then.
I had no idea that they thought dating like had such potential. Like, I think they were offering women, I don't know, like $20 or something to make videos, to put up on, make this a dating site. But they really thought like that's where they were going to get traction.
Yeah, there was a famous, I don't think it was, they considered it for a name, but Tune In, Hook Up was an early sort of slogan that thankfully for the world they didn't adapt. You know, I don't know exactly when they hired their first female for the team, but it was and their initial hires were a bunch of other dudes they knew from PayPal. So it was a male-heavy organization. Hot or Not, you know, I mean, like Facebook, as we all know, also started with the same concept.
Yes, yep.
There was an idea, I think, at the time that, you know, if you think about user-generated video, there was this big question about who would even want to watch amateur video and then who would even want to upload it, right? What were the sort of incentives for it? And dating seemed like a clear use case.
Was there, do you think, like a turning point when the founders knew, oh, this might work. This isn't just an idea. I think this is catching on.
You know, there's a couple, there's the sort of famous one, Ronaldinho, who's the soccer star, right?
Okay.
There was had uploaded this video. You can still go back and find it from 2006 in October, I believe, the timing right, where he's like doing these insane kicks, right? And so everyone there, initially there was this worry that it was copyrighted, right? It's like they don't know if the time he was signed with Nike, was it something that Nike put up? And I think YouTube did something that was a major reason they succeeded, is they knew the copyright law. They were willing to take risks like a startup could. They said, like, we're just going to assume that it's someone that's uploaded with permission until we hear otherwise. That ended up being like Nike's marketing department had actually like uploaded it as sort of like a stealth marketing tactic.
Okay.
And I think it was the first clip to pass a million views. But it was just first, like one of the earliest viral hits. The second one came up a few months later, which was Lazy Sunday, the like SNL skit.
Lazy Sunday, wake up in the late afternoon. Call Parnell just to see how he's doing. Hello, what up, Parn?
Yo, Sandberg, what's crackin'?
You thinking what I'm thinking?
Party up!
Man, it's happening. But first, my hunger pains.
And that one ultimately was pulled down. But there were some people that disagree that that was a turning point. But from what I understand, that was a major turning point of making YouTube go mainstream.
And that was pulled down because SNL was like, you don't have the rights to this.
That was pulled down because NBC. And eventually, NBC. After several weeks, there was this really fascinating, which just came up in the lawsuit, this fascinating exchange where YouTube had reached out and said, like, is this yours? If it is, we take it down. We'd be happy to remove it or to monetize it, you know, because they had learned from the Nike situation that there were scenarios in which, like, oh, it didn't actually look like it came from a company like Nike, but it actually did. And clearly, at one point, someone told me like Lazy and Sunday were like the two most popular. Actually, I think this might have been the lawsuit. Lazy and Sunday were the two most popular search term driving people to YouTube. And so that was a major watershed moment for the company. And, you know, talked to like a lot of early YouTubers and they're like, oh, the reason I discovered YouTube was because of Lazy Sunday.
It's interesting because you kind of touch on something there that is an interesting aspect to the both success and peril facing YouTube, which is like, it feels like a pile of lawsuits waiting to happen, like copyright infringements, all sorts of things. I wonder how worried people were in the beginning about that. Were they just like, whatever, we're young and broke, let's just go for it? Or, because I feel like to so many people, that would just seem like, oh my gosh, I have no idea whether I can use the CNN clip. I have no idea whether I can use this sports clip or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One is, you know, the founding team came out of PayPal, which did have this culture of sort of like, we are going to be willing to push the limits of regulation and rules and like ask for forgiveness later, right?
Yeah.
And it worked out really well. PayPal was sort of survived the dot-com crash. It turned into the PayPal mafia, right? YouTube is part of the PayPal mafia, like LinkedIn, SpaceX, Yelp, all these companies that came into these arguably like sort of gray areas of regulation. And YouTube, I believe it was almost a year into their founding, they hired their first full-time lawyer, Sahaba Lamin, who had come from Rhapsody.com, which is where a lot of early YouTube employees came from. This really interesting sort of pioneering online streaming service that had very intentionally not been like Napster. Like Rhapsody cut service licensing deals. They were sort of pushed out because of iTunes and Microsoft, right? Like big competition from existing tech companies. So their legal team, I think, was, you know, obviously like Viacom lawyers would argue otherwise, but pretty savvy about copyright law and about DMCA. You know, were they expecting a lawsuit that the magnitude of that Viacom came, which was in the winter of 2007? So, you know, shortly after the Google lawsuit. And from people I talked to inside Viacom, like, I don't think Viacom would have sued YouTube had Google not bought them.
I see. They thought there was some money in this lawsuit. Yeah.
At the time, Viacom was really worried about this site called Grokster, which has gone into the internet dustbin. But it was a early, like, one of the myriad video sites, and it was just ripping off, like, MTV and other, like, Viacom properties. And so I think, you know, the one thing to note is that YouTube, you know, had venture capital funding from Sequoia, and I think it was arguably more careful than some of the myriad other like online video competitors at the time.
It's interesting, though, because there's this kind of other side of like, yes, corporations are annoyed that YouTube is taking their stuff. And sometimes, as you say, like it results in a lawsuit. But sometimes, as like with Nike, you realize, wait, I can get SNL or Nike or whatever it is to be way more popular if I think of Google as like an additional platform to spread the word.
And that's what ultimately won YouTube the lawsuit against Viacom, which the initial verdict went in 2010, and then it was dragged out until 2013, I believe. But YouTube and Google, I mean, I'm sure Google's lawyers and Google's assets were a major reason why they won, but they were able to demonstrate that Viacom did precisely that, right? There were Viacom properties that were sort of secretly posting YouTube videos, the marketing teams, because they knew the value of YouTube as a marketing service, right? Hmm. And then you had one hand, they were going out and like posting these clips on YouTube. On the other hand, the lawyers were giving takedown notices. And so that was successfully demonstrated that YouTube was not violating copyright law. And that's been, you know, an early pitch from the company was, we are this amazing marketing channel for media. I think, you know, media was really, a lot of traditional media was kind of caught totally flat-footed around this. And this was, there were a lot of changing dynamics happening in the, like the TV and music world. But for sure, this was one of the greatest assets of YouTube and the strengths and the reason why it kind of moved forward with this case and was able to win.
You know, if we go back to the beginning of YouTube to 2005, what sort of was the state of regular television at that time? And do you feel like as YouTube has grown, television thinks of YouTube as helpful? Like, you know, yes, you can break it down to Saturday Night Live into little component parts and like they can take off on YouTube. Or do you think they think, oh, this is a huge threat? Like, how has that relationship, where did it start and how's it evolved?
Yeah, it's, you know, at the time, 2005, we were sort of in the like late stage of reality TV, right? I was shocked. I don't remember what season American Idol was, but it was pretty late. Like at that point, reality TV had already kind of had its first major wave, right? Our audiences were pretty familiar with it. I think the jig was up as far as like what it was, right? Like,
people
knew it was scripted and staged. But American Idol, I'm fairly sure, was the most popular show on TV around that time. And there were a lot of things happening where the big major networks were still dealing with some of the issues around cable. Like Netflix was still shipping DVDs at this point. So there was none of the sort of where we are now. And, you know, as I mentioned, like, they were kind of focused on threats like Grokster. They weren't really focused on YouTube as a viable threat, in part because for a long time, YouTube just didn't have a clear business model, right? Its advertising business really wasn't that successful. I think the TV networks for a long time resisted putting things on YouTube for that very reason. It looked like there's a famous quote from Jeff Zucker, right, about, like, I'm butchering it a little bit, but the idea was that, like, we don't want to trade like analog dollars for digital pennies. Mm-hmm. The idea was that the internet was just not monetizable, certainly not monetizable anywhere near like pay TV. I think over the years, you know, YouTube's strategy has shifted a lot on this, and past couple can jump forward a bit. Like more recently, they've just abandoned their sort of, they had a program with to do original scripted shows with some of the biggest YouTube stars that had some hits, right? But mostly a lot of duds. And I think now they've shifted towards basically like commerce and their competitor to TikTok. And I do think that a lot of the traditional media sees YouTube as much more of an ally when they're now, you know, going up against in the streaming wars. YouTube's not really competing with them in the streaming wars. Clearly, they're competing with them for eyeballs and for time, right? YouTube, TikTok, social media, everything's a competition for time. And right. YouTube is just taking up more and more of it over the years.
So, you know, you were talking about some of those first breakthroughs, the Saturday Night Live skit and the soccer, you know, like that little clip that people are watching. You say once YouTube starts taking off, like in a really serious way, this is a quote, every day the team had a simple edict, don't let YouTube.com crash. It kind of shows like where they are in the whole, like they're not really planning for the future or anything. They're just really trying to make sure things don't just completely melt down each and every day.
Yeah, I think there's the famous line about startups, right? Like building the tracks as you're writing it.
Yeah, yeah.
From what I understood, that's like exactly how it felt to YouTube, right? The engineers were sort of coming in, like working on their like modems and on the Caltrain coming into the office. Steve Chen, the co-founder, was sort of famous for like staying up super late and like responding and forwarding a bunch of like user complaints. That was at the time YouTube was a lot of the engineers worked at PayPal, and they had this joke where they would only use cash in the real life, right? Because they didn't want to use PayPal because it might tip over their service and make an outage. And they had this, you know, similarly, they didn't watch YouTube videos. That's sort of the joke around engineer. I'm sure they did, but they're like, no, we don't want to watch your video because that puts strain on the servers. So there was a lot of, you know, everything from the policy operation to the business operation, right? Like it was just, it's, you know, interesting the people that were there, they remember those, you know, 18 months before they joined Google, like very vividly. And then they may have spent like 3 years at Google, and that's kind of like, they don't, you know, to them that's less interesting. That was sort of putting in the operations. It's a lot of like melding with Google. It's like a lot more bureaucratic.
Right.
I mean, it was a period of tremendous growth and a lot of blind spots, but didn't quite feel as energetic and sort of chaotic as those initial 18 months, which is totally understandable. You know, I think that there are people there that weren't sure which direction it was going, right? There was a likelihood that they could have been sued out of existence, right? Or they could have, like, any day their growth could have stopped, or like something like Google or Yahoo could have come out with a competing version to just knock them out. And at that point, you know, Google Video was a competitor and probably like the chief competitor at one point.
Right.
And Google buying YouTube, you know, I have this really fascinating moment from the day of the acquisition that the founders were there, and like Sergey Brin from Google and Eric Schmidt came in to talk. And one of the first questions they had from YouTube employees is, what are you going to do with Google Video?
Yeah, well, I thought that was so telling that, like, so, you know, Google for a long time, like, has their eye on YouTube, not in necessarily we're going to acquire it kind of way, but in a, like, how do we beat these people kind of way. And as you say, with Google Video, and then Google kind of pulls the trigger on the sort of really, really big deal option, which is put Google Video on that like famous Google homepage, which, you know, they're very famous for keeping like very blank page, like not that much goes up there. They don't want to clutter it, you know, that kind of thing. But like the Google video proponents finally get told, like, yes, we're going to put it there. And then they know, like, that will just blow YouTube out of the water.
Yeah, there were a couple of so fascinating things happening in 2006. So there was Google Video's sort of initial strategy was the product was actually just doing like closed captioning. They were trying to just do what Google did on the web, right? Like index every single web page. They wanted to index every single TV show. And then they turned into sort of, oh, maybe we could do user-generated video. You know, initially, they moved incredibly cautiously. They would screen the videos that were uploaded. And so, you know, it's like if it's uploaded on a Friday afternoon, no one's going to look at it until Monday morning. And so if you're trying to post something, you can go to YouTube and post it immediately. Why would you go to Google Video, right? And part of this was Google had just been sued over Google Books. It recently purchased Blogger. It's sort of kind of putting its toe in to this new world of Web 2.0, of user-generated content that is incredibly legally risky. And I think that they also, in their strategy, it was so fascinating. They started off CES launching Google Video as a sort of place where you could see CBS shows. You could see Rocky and Bullwinkle. You could see NBA games. There was this idea that no one's really going to want to see the sort of lo-fi amateur stuff that's coming up on YouTube.
Right.
And within that year, they started off the year at CES in January with this announcement. And then you can just see within the year, they're like, oh, wow, like YouTube is, Eric Schmidt had forwarded this email that said, like, YouTube and MySpace are like cleaning our clocks. So there was this big pivot they had that included putting Google Video on the homepage. And it was saying, we're going to operate like YouTube. We're going to have sort of tagging features. We're going to look more social, look more like Web 2.0. At that point, YouTube had too much of a lead and Google Video just couldn't catch up.
So then the suitors start saying, like, we want to maybe acquire YouTube. I didn't realize News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, which owns Fox News, was like one of those suitors, Yahoo, Google. How did that play out? How did Google end up winning?
Sequoia, which was the early investor and probably like the driving investor behind YouTube, has a close relationship with Google. I think that was a big force behind behind the gate. Something that I reported that I learned in the reporting was that Sequoia was actually like around that time looking for a CEO of YouTube. Chad Hurley was sort of running it. Chad was under 30. Hadn't run a company before. This is something Sequoia's done with Google, right? They brought in Eric Schmidt to partner with the founders. They did something similar with Yahoo. At the time, this was like the natural thing to do, which is...
Right. It's like bringing in the adult. You've got the startup person and then the adult in the room. Okay.
Yeah. Now there's a bit more of a culture of the founder and you sort of bring in like a Sheryl Sandberg type, right? As opposed to a CEO. But so they had actually started at sort of around the same time they were going out and having conversations with potential CEOs. And then the acquisition talks began. And I think there's a variety, they were negotiating with record labels. There were some people I talked to that there was a sense that YouTube was sort of aware that if it stayed independent, its days were numbered for the legal reasons. Eric Schmidt is sort of at least people have identified him for being willing to throw on like an extra billion in the negotiations. I think at one point it was something like 600 million and he just smacked on 1.6.
Wow.
At the time, which was a massive sum, right? Like this was way well before the WhatsApp size acquisitions. Yahoo was the other contender. There's this, not my original anecdote, but I still love this one that Stephen and Chad met with Yahoo at this Denny's, trying to be low key. And then the next day.
Denny's is like a through line. Like Denny's, everybody, all the important meetings are at Denny's. And that's what I learned from your book.
I maybe get it mixed up, but they either met with Yahoo or... And then the next day, they decided to meet at the exact same spot.
Because everybody's trying to be like incognito, and they're like, let's just go to Denny's. Right. Okay.
I did not speak to the Google founders, and they haven't talked to media in years. But my sense is that, they care about at the time and still do. They think of Google as search. They think of Google as artificial intelligence. And YouTube was a massive search engine and a real viable threat to Google, which, Google Video was not picking up. And so they had the foresight to know that video was, kind of digital video was moving online and more of entertainment was moving online. And YouTube, they saw as a really fascinating search property. And it's the second largest search engine in the world and not often talked about that way, but it certainly is. And a lot of people use it that way. And so I think that was probably Google had, you know, Chad and Steve have mentioned this before. They really liked that alignment. They liked the promise to keep the brand and operations separate.
So Google is the biggest search engine and YouTube, which is owned by Google, is number two.
Yes. And I think, okay. I mean, it's, these are outside estimates, right? But I think that's fair to say.
So that, just to step back, that, wow.
There's some polls, I think there's maybe a couple years out of date that, you know, more people use YouTube on a regular basis than Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. You know, it's functionally different than social media, right? It's, YouTube is in some ways social media, but in many ways it's not. It's a repository. You know, most people use it like for how-to videos or like old clips they want to find, right? It serves a really important search function. It's also for a lot of people a significant social network, right? They have these sort of parasocial relationship with YouTube stars. It's the primary entertainment for a lot of people under the age of 24, right? Like, it's, you know, TikTok is sort of also, TikTok's not really social. We think of it as social media. And I think YouTube is even more, has just like the stronger, just because it's been part of Google for so long, it's got the strong engineering. Like, it's very, very good at search. And that's had a host of problems, but at least like that's something that it does very, very well.
So, you know, when YouTube gets acquired by Google, you really describe a kind of, I guess I would say, like, culture clash, or at least culture shift. How were things different once, you know, like, what did the YouTubers chafe against at Google?
Yeah, I mean, this is a bit reductive, but I do think, like, people at Google didn't watch YouTube, right? Mm-hmm. Like, YouTube was, it always has been sort of had this, you know, clearly it's got a wide audience of viewers from all different age range, but it's like sweet spot has always been teens, been like young, sort of the like zeitgeist of youth that was kind of inexplicable to Google and to Google execs. You know, one of the biggest early stars on YouTube was Fred. Is this name character, and I don't know if you remember this at all. He had like this really obnoxious like chipmunk squeal voice.
No.
Yeah. Go back and watch some Fred. Okay. But Fred was huge.
Hey, it's Fred, and I need to go grocery shopping. I don't really know what to get because my mom gave me a grocery list, but I ate it because I was hungry, so I guess I'm going to have to wing it. I need to get something for my mom. Anti-diarrheal pill.
And Fred was like very bewildering to, and I think representative, and one of the early, you know, Fred ended up making some movies for Nickelodeon, like one of these sort of early, like, YouTube stars. And so the culture clash, it was there. There was this sense, there was a lot of the early YouTube people came up in this sort of, like, LiveJournal world of, like, early web. You were kind of navigating what they saw as these communities, right? And so YouTube had this, one of the fascinating things that I learned in this book was that YouTube had an early team of community managers. And their job was basically like curating the homepage for everyone. And so at one point, you know, we all landed on YouTube.com. We kind of saw the same thing. And so they saw that as this really fast, like, virtual town square, right? This idea that, sure, we're all going to watch very different things on YouTube and have different interests, but we can all kind of come together and share something as like a shared community. And at that point, like, still early on, there was a sense, like, a lot of people who watched were also making videos. I think you're seeing that kind of with TikTok too. But back then, it's hard for us to appreciate, but back then it was, the line between like viewer and creator was blurry. That changed as it scaled up, right? Google, so it pushed YouTube to expand globally. There became a point where, from people I talked to, and YouTube leadership too, but the Google side, like, that sort of community management curation doesn't scale, one.
Right.
And they also thought, you know, they're going up against a lawsuit of a Viacom that's accusing them of not going through and finding copyrighted material. And then you have this team of people that whose job is to, like, sift through the site and, like, find things. And so they felt like that was legally risky. So around 2010, they actually got disbanded that team. I think it was this sort of, like, quiet, pivotal moment in the company's history where they move toward, at this point, Facebook was becoming this very urgent threat for Google. And like Google was beginning to work on Google Plus, it's sort of its failed social network, right? And so this algorithmic feeds became much more important and became the direction of YouTube that they haven't turned away since. And so that was part of the reason that, you know, a lot of early YouTube people, right, there's some nostalgia for the way it was. But I do think they thought of the site and its values a lot differently. They didn't really think of it as a platform, right? They thought of it as a community. And I think that's an important distinction.
There's been a lot of sort of bumps in the road at YouTube, and you alluded to some in terms of the founding, in terms of Steve Chen having a seizure and having to kind of bow out of the company ultimately. You write a little bit about this really jarring moment in YouTube's history, which is there was a shooting in New Zealand at two mosques in the city of Christchurch, and the perpetrator, who ultimately killed more than 50 people, asked people, I mean, this was like during the course, I think he filmed himself during shooting, asked himself to subscribe to one of the most popular YouTube creators, PewDiePie. You know, I want to get into the reaction from YouTube to that in a minute, but just explain who, if for people who don't know, who is this person, PewDiePie, and like, what has he meant to YouTube?
So, yeah, I mean, I can go, PewDiePie was, I came online in 2010, which is kind of relatively late in YouTube's existence. And by that time, there was sort of a vibrant niche of gaming streamers. And so like people that would, you know, they call it Let's Play format, right? You open up a video game, popular one, sometimes a really obscure one, and you film yourself playing. PewDiePie also came, so he's a Swede. He's an attractive guy. He's charismatic. You know, at the time when his popularity really started to peak, there were all sorts of articles trying to like unpack him for mainstream audiences. Right, if you're over the age of 40, he can kind of be a mystery about why this guy is so popular, which is, I think, the case for a lot of YouTubers. But he also ascended at the same time that YouTube had adjusted its algorithm. So initially, the platform was favoring views, and just that was the sort of the core metric that it had. And so it came to a problem that a lot of the early internet came and arguably the internet is still wrestling with, is clickbait, right? Someone will make a video designed just to get people to click, and then people might leave. And YouTube saw that in the data. And around that time that PewDiePie came on, actually was when the company really started to see one of its first kind of worrying plateaus, worrying for YouTube, plateaus in growth. And mobile hadn't really taken off yet. And the company made this really a seismic shift to begin measuring watch time. And they started favoring videos that got the longest watch time and engagement. Gaming was just tailor-made for that. You know, gaming, it's relatively low maintenance. You don't need a lot of production values. You're not trying to create films. You can kind of do it in your dorm room, which is where PewDiePie started. And at the same time, it's also really tailor-made for search. PewDiePie was a master of sort of playing a lot of really popular games. You tag the videos, like those, you know, those games, people are searching for them online. Right. They're searching for them on YouTube. His views go up to the top.
Got it.
And so, yeah, he became this really significant star, went through a lot of controversy starting around 2016. And by the time the Christchurch shooting in 2019, he was still the most popular on the way to getting 100 million subscribers. And had just developed this really core fan group, this very deeply kind of strange moment where the subscribe to PewDiePie mantra became this sort of counterculture, like anti-establishment rallying cry.
Yeah, so then it gets mentioned, right, by the killer.
It was mentioned in the Christchurch shooting from all the available, like the New Zealand government report and the analysis of the Christchurch shooting. The shooter and the terrorist in that case just mentioned PewDiePie in order to get attention. A YouTube executive described it as sort of a shooting, an act meant to go viral, right? It was a tragedy tailor-made to and designed to for internet virality. And this is something we've seen regrettably, like these sort of tragedies repeat themselves and like latch on to someone like PewDiePie, who's this controversial figure, but deeply popular.
And so within YouTube, obviously, like, I mean, I think you wrote about, like, they were, a lot of the top folks were at a retreat when this happens. I mean, That must have rocked YouTube, the people within the company who work there. And here's this horrific shooting that goes on. And what is invoked? Like a YouTube star.
Yes. It's just one of several moments, I think, in the company's history where they just had no idea what was happening or how to respond. The thing I discovered in my reporting was that they were just about to, the company had for 2 years sort of kept its distance from PewDiePie, right? So just to give a really quick recap for listeners, there in early 2017, the Wall Street Journal reported that PewDiePie had had a series of videos that were being praised by a neo-Nazi website. He had a partnership with Disney at the time. Disney drops him. YouTube sort of drops their business. They had an original show with him. It began this like Trump era. Like it was the first sort of early, this was before like, cancel culture was really a phenomenon. And before social platforms had dealt with this degree of Trump era culture wars, really, to be honest. And so for 2 years, PewDiePie was still very popular. YouTube still ran ads on his channel, but they didn't promote him in any way, right? He wasn't like other stars they will have up on stage, their tweet out, right? There's like this intimate relationship between YouTube and its creators. And they kept their distance from PewDiePie for 2 years and were just preparing now to reengage because they thought he demonstrated that he was, at least they demonstrated to their standards, right, that he was demonstrating responsibility. I think he had such a huge fandom that they really couldn't afford to stay away. I think that was a major issue that he kind of held them captive in some ways because of his popularity. And so there's this tragic moment where it was this mass shooting that was tied up with this big YouTube star. And I think the deeper issue here is that, you know, sort of the mass shooting itself was informed by this belief in white nationalism. And there's been a lot of research and arguments that that's something that social media platforms, YouTube included, have not done enough to address over the years.
When you think about where YouTube is headed and what they want to do, what do you think that is?
There's an anecdote I didn't include in the book, but I'll give it to you here. There was a while ago, there were some rumors about a movie studio being up for sale, and it may have been MGM, which Amazon ended up buying. And I remember talking to the banker and this reporting and thinking like, well, has YouTube ever been interested, right? YouTube has this massive library. At one point long ago, they were talking with Netflix about purchasing Netflix, and it had eyed Twitch, right? So YouTube had sort of, in the past, Google had thought that they could sort of tack on these rather large services and disparate services to YouTube. I remember bankers saying that they spoke to someone high up at Google and they're like, why doesn't the studio just put all their stuff on YouTube? Which is very telling about sort of how Google thinks that they want to be everything for everyone, right? They'd much rather, and you started to see them do this recently where they sort of, after years of initially were trying to put movies and TV shows up, and now you can kind of rent a lot of movies and TV shows directly on YouTube. They're no longer sort of trying to compete with the Netflix and Disney Pluses of the world. That's been a recent strategy shift. And I think they are comfortable being the sort of largest ad-supported video service on the internet and not putting as much money. I think there are people that could question that strategy, but they've shifted much more into basically just trying not to get eaten by TikTok.
I was going to ask where they saw competition coming from, but it sounds like TikTok is a big one.
TikTok. Yeah. And for a long time, it was Facebook. I still think that certainly Facebook is a threat. I think TikTok and Amazon, Amazon is more of a threat to Google's core business, right? If we think about Google's core business is in search advertising, where people are spending more of their time, especially around like consumer commercial goods, right? They're going to Amazon. Amazon has been quietly building up this digital advertising business. And then Amazon has Prime Video and MGM Studios and investing a lot in video. They've made a lot of false starts. And I don't, Amazon has tried to court creators, I think, with little luck. TikTok is the one that's had a much more traction where you're seeing, a lot of YouTube creators and stars you have to be on TikTok, basically, or spending a lot of time there. A lot of viewers, young viewers, are spending much more time on TikTok. So I think, and YouTube Shorts is a direct competing, like Instagram Reels is basically a TikTok clone. And it's YouTube's attempt to curb that threat.
And do you think that there's real concern inside Google and YouTube that, I mean, the arrival of a TikTok could be a real problem, or like that this could be a real problem for the growth of the business of YouTube?
My understanding of how they think about this is that they think about it as sort of the, I think what Vine solved first, and then Vine like got over, tripped over its skis, but was just the ease of content creation. YouTube has historically been, you could use it with a flip cam, right? But then as production values, this is a really interesting tension in YouTube. Like over the years, there was this sort of creators have felt this demand to have more and more production values. And you look at like Mr. Beast, one of the most popular YouTubers, has this massive production team that like rivals anything on TV. And so there is this pull towards like, we need to have like, in order to get advertising dollars, in order to get attention, we need to have like invest a lot in production, right? Like, and then what TikTok comes around, it's like, no, you can actually just create videos with your phone. And so I think YouTube, and talking to people there, that that was something that they felt like, wow, we had nothing to offer this sort of lo-fi, like Instagram, TikTok, right? Snapchat, it's really easy to create. Whereas YouTube, it became sort of arguably like a lot more hurdles to be able to get up on YouTube, and a lot of it's discovery, right? If you're I think this might be changing given just TikTok moves so quickly, so it's hard to say, but you know, talk to a lot of creators about this and they say like TikTok is a way to kind of get in front of a lot of people really quickly and get discovered, whereas YouTube is just so crowded and really hard. Unless you have millions of subscribers, it's really hard to find, to break through and find a new audience, or break through and find any audience, to be honest. And so I think YouTube is afraid of that. They're afraid of that. I think less so maybe even, I don't think there's a real concern about advertising dollars shifting to TikTok right now in mass. And there's an argument that Google actually, given its antitrust issues, is probably wants TikTok to be successful so it can point to regulators and say like, look, we have a viable
competitor
here.
Right.
But I think they are concerned about the sort of demand and supply side of their that supply side, that like video creators will just give up on YouTube. And that's a major reason why they've invested so much in YouTube Shorts.
Mark Bergen is the author of Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And thanks, as always, to you for listening. Coming up next week,
I think generally leaders, I often find, get abstracted away from the thing that they originally got passionate about, because now they're a leader and they have to, you know, everything's very proper. And when they show up, everything's very almost synthetic and created for them. And I think that is a very dangerous position to get into as a leader when you get very far away from your customers and, frankly, when you get very far away from your employees.
You can subscribe to Instigators of Change on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review while you're there. Our show is produced by Matt Purdy. We'll talk to you next week.